Well, it's just a real pleasure to introduce Don Wellman today, someone I've known since 2008, when out of nowhere I sent him a copy of an anthology that my wife Lisa and I had edited and published called Process, which was really our own learning process, trying to figure out the lay of the literary land in Gloucester, which we've just moved back to, all things connected to it. And I sent him a copy of that. He was so generous, he sent back one of his own, a magazine called Oars that he had edited. And then I got the rest of the copies of that series that he had done. And I think since then he's been a substantial influence on me, on my in the language of my own poems, which become increasingly Baroque. And they have. The language has become more, not just complex, but I think the word Baroque has to stand without any further description. And also going into hybridity, which is a very fraught and complex concept now. Hybridity can be used as a term to mean that things can be smoothed over, or they can come together in such a way that conflict is erased. But with Don, who's likewise a very hybridized Yankee like I am, a New Englander who also is Catholic in other ways, and Irish, French, and English, and all these other things that make up New England, to go deeper into that local hybridity. He was really nice to ask me to write an introduction for a forthcoming volume of his, a bilingual selected poems coming out in Spain. A literary foundation associated with the University of Valencia is bringing it out, called Night Rowing. Is that still the title, Don? Night Rowing. So in that introduction, which I'm pulling from that introduction, I attempted to follow the arc of his poetry, which is a form of a life journey, really, where the poet seeks correspondences between these internal complexities, internal hybridities, these folds, a sense of Leibniz, these folds, these internal folds, and then how those connect to these extraordinary places we go, and people we meet, and phenomena that we encounter on this pilgrimage. And in this introduction, I called Don Wellman's pilgrimage a counter-pilgrimage. And the arc of his poetry, and at least in this bilingual volume, leads him to Santiago de Compostela and Iglesias. But that journey begins not in Spain, it begins in Maine, in the Cranberry Islands. And that's really what tonight's about, is this volume, the Cranberry Islands series, which is the beginning of a journey. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Cranberry Islands. They're a small island chain off the coast of Mount Desert Island. So they're islands of an island. And they were colonized a couple hundred years ago by Don's mother's ancestors, the Bunkers, who've been there in this small, relatively isolated place. You can go into this, obviously, in detail. And this is kind of a point of commonality for me and Don, because my family, the Riches, colonized what might be like the next island over, Frenchboro, where they lived for 100 years in isolation before they came to Gloucester. So, and that part of Maine, again, is a contentious borderland for centuries between the French and British empires, between Anglophone empire and the native peoples who were there. So, I mean, that goes back to when the English colonists burned the French Catholic mission of Saint-Sauveur, which is now Fernald Point, in 1613, which is 400 years ago this July. So there's a very deep history that Don is tapping into. There are poems that are investigative. They interrogate memory, especially childhood memory. They follow threads from self to place, and threads which connect poet to poet. Charles Olson's excavation of his childhood Gloucester in the Maximus poems, and as an adult reckoning with his many changes and submerged histories, that project is one of several which stand behind this book, the Cranberry Island series, making it especially appropriate that Don Wellman would be here tonight to read from it. Thank you, David. What you have before you in the Cranberry Island series, I was wondering what to title it. It turns out that the Cranberry Island series is a geological term for the oldest layer of magmatic rock in North America. So this book sort of has as its mission
to trace the human imprint in some way through mythology and through some suffering in my family related to the Vietnam War and Agent Orange-based pollution of the environment. So it's a long journey through multiple births and multiple transitions and lots of hybridity. I was reading through a volume that I had put together probably as early as 1975. So you're going to hear some of those poems. That's part of the mythological process that's at hand here. I also use the term autoethnography to say that although this is a life story, it's a life story done in an objective way, as though I were an anthropologist of my own family and circumstances. And I think Olson has been very helpful in that. It's a hugely good time for me. There are flyers and some other books back there. There is a book of pilgrimage writing set in Europe and North Africa. There is a flyer. I'm having several books of translation being published shortly. I'm just so happy about everything like that. I'm going to read, therefore, one of the earliest... No, I don't know if I will. Yeah, I'm going to read a poem that sort of sets it all off, and you may hear some of these images again among my threads. It's called Waterman. Wellman is Waterman, water carrier, tender of springs. Is he a half man, healer that plays the water drum? Does his mind keep time with the time kept by the ensemble? He is a various man, rogue man, he who opens the moon gate, tidal man. Fish are his thoughts, for him fish are speech, golden bream in the russet waters of Piscataquag. He feels the tug of the current on the line that he pays from the stern of the sky raft. Salt spray in his beard, he knows the sweet water that flows from underground springs over the seawall of pebbles and shell. He seeks provisions for the homeward voyage, his drum, his canoe. Well, those of you who know Olson, this line, fish are his thoughts, is pure Charles Olson. And the bit about rowing on the river, that happens to be Henry David Thoreau. So my work tends to be a pastiche. High Brazil. This appears on navigation maps of the North Atlantic. At one time I was going to translate an Anglo-Saxon epic of one of the saints' lives. St. Brendan has a similar circumstance. In his voyages into the Atlantic, he once celebrated Mass on an island that he named High Brazil. Some people think it was the back of a whale, but it was a miracle that he was able to land on that whale. High Brazil. Somewhere waves turn to stone. Somewhere off the coast of the mainland, trees of seaweed brush the legs of the swimmers. New forces build High Brazil. Somewhere beyond the reach of the watchers who hold the headlands, who hurl stones at the swimmers, glints of sunlight build an island. Branches of seaweed slow the arms, waves cut the feet of those who make the newfound land. Wind stunts the growth of trees. A voice calls the names of the fathers who made the stone alphabet, who carried stones into the sea and made new lands with old names. Voices make a sun of driftwood, and appoint a watch over fire and island. The swimmers hold stones in their sleep. For some, sleep renews the island. Others return to the sea, arms slow with the weight of stones. Somewhere waves crest. Somewhere waves without crests wash over the shore of high Brazil. Not bad for 1970, huh? So that sort of was one of the triggers for this book. I was planning to take a PhD in Anglo-Saxon at the University of Oregon. Haystepper is a kenning for a deer. Footprints on frozen channels between tussocks of bog turf. Wind owns the heath. Frost bends the sedge. Ice, the coldest seed. The heart slows. The hand that knots water at times untwists the threads, at times writes lesson and season. Bones of a stag, grit interfuses the sheen. I am what I hold, house and ossuary. Where stumps have washed ashore, salt gray roots, I light a bonfire for all that shall. Be coals. Well, that's your introduction to Cranberry Island, which has about a 900-acre piece of land, and 200 acres are a bog. And that was an Anglo-Saxonized version of the history of the bog. I've got to watch my time. I know I've got tons of time, but I don't want to overdo it either. So there's this essay on Olson's transcription of a text by a different Rich on the Gulf of Maine and the Indian presences, and that's one of the themes in this collection. Some of the essays, there are three ethnographic essays that explore family roots. David mentioned some of them. The woman on the cover, her mother, we said, was a Penobscot. She was probably half Penobscot. So hybridity is in every chapter of this collection. This is another part of the North Atlantic voyage. I often dream the first three or four lines of my poems. And it's often because of some quality of rhythmic intensity. In this case, I was sleeping. I'd come back from the Virgin Islands, the tropics, and I heard a man speaking to me in the down east heavy sort of accent. But the words that he was speaking were a translation of words that had sounded something like this. Meich be meservum sosgid sejan huich ja dagum erfoth huil oft throida thonathem shifu beim clivum knosath, which is one of the great Anglo-Saxon elegies, The Seafarer. I'm going to read my modern English version of part of that poem. I have to say this too. As I had 4.5 lines, it turned out that each line was exactly 48 characters. So I look at it as a quilt or a weaving rather than the traditional Anglo-Saxon poetry. I want to speak the truth to tell about my travels and the hardships which I have endured, the feelings in my breast when I heard the keel groan, terrible heavings of the sea. Nights I had to keep a close watch, clinging to the prow when the boat plunged, seas breaking over ledges. Chains of ice held me fast by the legs, iron fetters of frost. Sorrow, sighing, hot in the heart, like fire. I fought hunger and mind, see, weary from watchfulness. You who have it also easy on land don't know how. Poorly I fared on the cruel winter. See, loneliness, longing for close friends, rhyme, icicles in my beard. Hail, scur, flew, I heard not but hammering seas, gannets song to me, the ducks played games to amuse me, cormorants song and muse, skittering were all my mead, gulls screaming when the seas beat against cliffs, the dusky feathered eagles screeching a reply, no glee nor any comfort had I from those ice-winged companions. Believe me, you gallant city folk, wine-flushed, sitting in your houses, the path over the swelling seas is baleful, traveling a shadowy night with snow from the north and frost vaulting the sky. Hailstones, the coldest seed falling, yet I want to set out once more upon the wind winding salt streams and seek a land far, far away from here. No rewards are so good, no pleasures of youth or deeds so worthwhile, no leaders so deserving of respect that they can hold me back from doing what I must. Heart, gold rings, a smiling wife, no thing of that, of what you have suits me, as does the onward flowing waves, though once at sea I will long for those joys, orchards, blossoms, walls are fair, meadows bright, earth speeds well, all urges my mind and heart to set out upon the far flooding seas. The cuckoo, fair weather friend, with taunting stirs the bitter thoughts I keep close to my breast. How can someone living in luxury know what it feels like to choose the way of renunciation? And so my soul takes wing, flies from my breast. My mood with the flood tide visits regions where none but whales dwell above the sheeting waves coming back to me. The lone flyer yells, wets my spirit to follow it greedily over the water, dearer to me, my maker's glory than dead life, lone of land. I decided to take the 48 letter count as a prosodic entity. I think you might have heard that. I need my water. It's right here. I think. Sure, next time. I'll have another water break after this. So James and David, I think, published this in one of the issues of Polis. This gets to the history of the Cranberry Islands themselves. Prologue, the Cranberry Island series. Men who burned islands for sheep to graze became farmers, haying the salt marsh with long wooden rakes. Two in a photo look prosperous. The loads of straw poised on their shoulders, mid-air like suns. Lichen hides an eye, cut in stone, brothers lost at sea. After storms, some walk the shore path, seeking salvage, a shell heap under fallen spruce. Pebbles and sod adhere to roots abstractly. The graveyard is the oldest village. After the burial, the shaman causes a flame to rise, corn from the mound. I find I'm experimenting with lines of between 3 and 5 syllables and trying to feel an actual, almost blank verse prosody at the same time. many gates. Who knows why? People build weird things and leave them in the woods. One thing left in the woods was called Watergate. I don't know what it refers to. This is called Many Gates. It has several parts. One, in 1923, the harbor froze. Birth waters flowed through life gates. Snow light in the eyes of the man who led the horse. Glide sledge, wind, bring joy in birthing. Speed well over raw ice. Mary, your songs made a garden in the ears of your daughters. Irish Mediterranean mother, dreaming your children to health in fields afloat off the coast of the Maine. Speech rhythms change slowly. Part three. The second given name of the first male child, the surname of a dear male friend, John Gilman Bunker. Amanda, his second wife, of whom his daughter and granddaughter rarely speak. Penobscot fashioned baskets from sweet grass gathered here from meadows that border the pool. One, a friend or a cousin who sometimes visited my Aunt Elzada. My mother, the fourth generation in this maternal line, now at one with the peace we knew in her presence. Graveyard tombolos that divides ocean and bay. A poetry of facts may, as drums write, speak in pure tones. Stones do not know life, death they describe. A cow amid rowan and blueberries, mother's father's face, the westering sun. The makers of red pots did not disappear. A technology of woven grass developed, vessels of birch bark more lissom and easy to carry, motion and counter-motion, stone to bone, iron to tin, plastic heads on fish traps. Trade begins on islands and travels coastwise, pursuing salmon ever swiftly up winding rivers, marshes north and west. Catkins, sedge for summer shelter, winter ice, logs and slash, frozen to the rock face, reflect Cathay, a mountain of gold at the headwaters of the Penobscot, fabled Norum Bega, El Dorado, 5. Fur and cod, he wrote, Portuguese founding fishing stations, Sable Island to Cap Raz, north and south and east to Greenland. Lumber and Johnny Cake south to the West Indies, molasses to northern North Shore distilleries, the cosmos inscribed on the Ming vase in the foyer at Wiscasset, runners of Malaysian teak, spiral balustrades of mahogany, a widow perishes of solitude, the crew lost at the ice ascends to sky windows. 6. Pobbles gathered from half-moon coves, used to pave thoroughfares, Boston, Louisburg Square. One indentured boy learned to read and write in exchange for his labor. As many stones as the dory holds, so many times the stone skiff must be rowed out to the bark to complete her load. Each stone passes 6, 8 times or more through the boy's hands before the mountain arrives at the stone wharf, Charleston. Spring water runs through sluice gates into an icy pond, mossy earthworks, graves under thorn, brush breaks into swamp, alder and hatmatack, and a slow motion wave seed the heath with acid-resistant roots. Tide and storm wash pebbles over the seawall, inundate, fence post, barbed wire, cattle gate. Tufts of the Cranberry Island series, interbedded with siltstones and slates, fragile wedges Fresh water seeps from the spongy peak, the red-brown of oxidized iron. Ledges are properly sea marks, cow yard with white horse and thumper, black rocks awash at low water, east bunker's ledge where a scorned wife was left to drown. So many have disowned this island and yet desire to return. So that's that. That goes on through the essays, that kind of stuff. I'm going to try something that may not be as poetically interesting. I'm not sure. There are four pieces of prose here, and one of them pertains to Charles Olson. It's called My Life Tangent to the Charles Olson Circle. I never knew Charles Olson, but I grew up partly on Cranberry Island, as did Olson's daughter, Kate. From the time that I was 11, Kate was in our house as a sister to my two sisters. And that repeated itself until her death. And so this is, it's almost like some of my stuff in exercise. It's like, we're talking about Lisa Jarno's recent biography of Robert Duncan. It's like everybody I ever knew who is famous, I just drop their name as I'm weaving the story. And I'm going to skip around. But I'm also real aware that I'm tagging people. And I wonder what they would think if they read this, because I've tagged them in it. And to me, this is the big issue for an anthropologist, is how do you tell somebody's story so that they will say, "Oh, that's me. You still have my water?" Oh, okay. I'm still all set. So I read a little bit from the beginning of this essay called, and notice it's my life. It's not Kate's life. It's not Charles Olson's life. It's my life tangent to the Charles Olson circle. In 1969, July or August, Charles Olson visited Cranberry Island to help his daughter Kate prepare for her first year at Sarah Lawrence. In the transcript of a conversation with Herbert Kenny, Olson mentions this visit and shows his familiarity with the history of the region. He comments on the dividing line that once separated Loyalist America from the rebelling colonies. He identifies Somes Sound with that line. On either shore of the sound, a fjord or deep water inlet, are multiple small mountains with exposed dome-like summits, hence the name given to the region by Samuel de Champlain in 1604, Île des Monts Déserts. The Cranberry Islands sit in the great harbor of Mount Desert, 2 miles from the mouth of the sound. In his conversation with Kenny, Olson also comments wryly that the work of bringing Christianity to the fishermen, which was important to John Winthrop, is an enterprise that has continued on the coast of Maine, citing the work of the Seacoast Mission. You will find references to Edith Drury and the Seacoast Mission in the essay, Cranberry Isles Remembered Histories. You will also find a perspective on the dividing line between Loyalists and Rebels in the essay, Witness for Elsie. Of note is the apparent fact that the Bunkers, my mother's family, who had settled on the hill which bears their name in Charleston, Massachusetts, yielded their property to the Puritans out of disdain for religious intolerance. 2 generations after the arrival of Winthrop to Boston, the Bunkers were to be found in Dover, New Hampshire, and Machias, Maine, soon after John and Joseph Bunker had settled on Great Cranberry Island. In 1969, I'm just pointing out that no essay is complete. There are 2 other essays that you actually need to complete the meaning of the paragraph that I just read. In 1969, when Olson visited, I was in Germany, having been drafted into the U.S. Army for Vietnam-era duty, and then enlisting for a choice of assignments. My son, Tague, Gaelic for poet, was born on July 7th, which is also my birthday. the hospital where Paula delivered him being in plain view of Plymouth Rock. One day that July, I was reading the selected poems of Ezra Pound in a snack bar in the Kaserne at Bad Kreuznach. Another soldier approached my table. Evan Jones was a true aficionado, as it turned out, of Basil Bunting, Louis Zukofsky, and Olson. He had met Bunton in Santa Barbara and felt particularly close to him. Evan's BFA project in photography was a portrait of Bunting. My friendship with Evan is the earliest tangent inscribed with the name Charles Olson. Kleber's Beowulf. In my kit, Evan had his Olson, Bunting, and Zukofsky. I was reading Pound because I intended, after service, to return to graduate school. Of this first encounter with Olson's poetry, I remember the sense of place, the relation of the USCGS map on the cover of the Jargon Corinth edition of the Maximus poems. You see how we echoed it. This is the 1870 USCGS map of the Cranberry Islands. Well, it goes on like that. I'm just going to skip a little bit. The timeline is not very straightforward, by the way. It's because I'm a Baroque artist, as David noted. Twisting gyres. 1962-1968. Once when drinking from my mug of beer, the foam ran down my chin. Russian folk tales begin with that trope. Did you know that a Russian battleship moored at Islesford, Little Cranberry Island, during the period of the signing of the peace treaty concluding the Russo-Japanese War, 1904-1905? I am told that I have Russian cousins, but in 1962, I was 17, sitting in a beer stube somewhere in Heilbronn, Germany, searching for the father to whom I gave the magical name of Sergeant Gott. Great Scott being an island near Cranberry. My life, like that of Jack Kerouac, is another version of the Parsifal story. Too dumb to ask the right question at the right time, even though hearing inscrutable error answers. I had resolved to become at least a minor poet. I had discovered Percy Bysshe Shelley and was under the sway of Thomas Hardy's Jude the Obscure. Spender, with his prophetic pylon, Shelley and Hardy, was all that I knew of poetry. I'm going to return to this essay, but I'm going to skip ahead to a poem, since I mentioned Jack Kerouac, which is called Jack, and which is actually a poem about my dad. Jack. And I used to ramble in the wasteland behind the Lake Street factory, seeking Sergeant Gott, our liberator. He was off to the war in Korea. It was a fable like Parsifal. Clack, clack, a stick beating the white fence. Another stick cut from an alder jumped and dodged like an animal on a leash, hopping as it bumped the cracks in the wall, in the walk. Jack's aunt, he said, had buried a cat in the garden with a vertical Madonna bathtub shrine. Or was it his brother? When the sleigh passed down Hollis Street, the hard candies rained on the pavement like grenades. The fingers were bent and bruised. My sisters wanted to murder me. In the yard of the bakery, the electric cars went in circles all night. There was a crash, and one turned over, its motor screeching like a maimed horse. The policemen chased us home like cops and robbers into the tenements of humiliation and poverty. My dad had yellow teeth. His mother sold cigars. Our Lithuanian neighbor gathered crate wood from the different grocery stores on Main Street and transported it home in a radio flyer wagon. He broke it into bundles and stored them in the yard. To me, he was the same old man Mike who threw furniture around before a storm. The barber kept the black Cadillac in a rented space in the horse barn. There was also a hearse. Joe Bedard was a muscular locomotive mechanic who strolled home from Union Station, stripped to his singlet like a wrestler, black from head to foot with machine oil. He could not raise his arm to comb his hair. Like my father, I have one eye. Shadows still surprise me, confusing fact and fiction. Somewhere in a sandpit famous for rattlesnakes are the paws of deserted boxcars rustling in the chemical breeze. A world transfixed in suspended dust, a metallic throb in the jaw. Night winds carry emanations from the cellar, mold and damp cold and kerosene, wildly sprouting potatoes with lavender tentacles. My father dreamed that showgirls danced in the alley. Tijan was not a happy man. You know that Tijan is what Kerouac was called as a boy.
The bunker. Olson's wife was a bunker. So
yes, well, there's a little bit of that. Katie's stepdad was a James Bunker, who was not immediately related to the Cranberry Island bunkers, which is kind of interesting and odd, and I may have something of that in here. But the bunkers apparently went to two places after they left Bunker Hill. They also went to Nantucket, and the Nantucket bunkers, among other things, and ended up owning American Sugar Refinery Company and were part of the Hudson River Dutch colony eventually. And that's where James Bunker, Katie's... Is his name James? Connie's husband. Stems from that group. I know him. He was a lovely man. I'm going to read a couple more bits from the Kate essay now. Polis. So that was Nashua, by the way, you know, an industrial town. But I don't know if Nashua is my home. I live nearby now, or Cranberry Island. I don't know where I live. Polis. I am a displaced island person dwelling in a dark and winding river valley in the mountains of New Hampshire. I am a person of big and deep skies and winds over exposed meadows. Islands are mountains in the sea. I am a mountain climber. In 1976, Paula, Tad, and I relocated to a goat farm on the island of St. Croix, U.S. Virgin Islands. I taught English in a school that prided itself on its experiments with intensive education and its commitment to serve multiracial populations. My landlady spoke a Danish Creole that very few living today understand. Tom Reeves, the dean, was aware of Olson's work at Black Mountain College and was himself a member of the community of poets that produced the literary magazine Fag Rag. Allen Ginsberg, John Wieners, Freddie Greenberg, Charlie Shively, John Mitzel, Jonathan Williams, and Ron Bays, all associated with Fag Rag, have played different roles in my personal and literary life. I have experienced the beauties and agonies of homoerotic love shared by this community. When I had the opportunity to introduce Tom to Jack Helliker and Cranberry, their embrace spoke volumes of expressive fellowship. Jack had traveled for some months in Europe with John Cage and Merce Cunningham. Sitting on the stairs leading to the organ loft at La Sainte Trinité in Paris, guided there by Pierre Boulez, they had listened to Olivier Messiaen play multiple tangents here to Black Mountain College and the Olson Circle. Among contemporary composers, Jack was particularly close to Lou Harrison. Olson had a high regard and jocular affection for Lou, writes Michael Rumiker. This twisting together of threads in this simple narrative of my life and some tangent to Kate's. Kate's letters, dating from 1966, when she first entered boarding school in Cambridge, reference a daughter's fantasy of polis shared with her dad. My sister Margaret remembers seeing Kate in the rocker on the porch of her house with a copy of Whitehead's Process and Reality. Kate often, with her Lhasa Apso in her lap and Margaret at the oars, rowed around the harbor in a beautiful wooden skiff, teal blue hull, eggshell interior. Connie writes to Kate in 1966, saying, oddly, that the daughter has developed motherly feelings for the father. In the correspondence between Kate and Connie, Connie often counsels Kate about her seriousness in regards to her relationship to her dad. For instance, she writes, "Don't assume that because you had a bad summer, it should be a mark of your fate." A letter from the same sequence from the summer of 1967 states, "I am sure Charles felt good to be able to blow up at you, and it is a sign of how secure he does feel with you." That winter, Connie writes to Kate, having spoken to Charles on the phone, "He says if you will just knock on the door, not try to plan too far ahead, he loves it." Here are glimpses of a passionate intensity shared by father and daughter, a shared proclivity to become absorbed and frustrated by deep personal needs. I'm going to read the conclusion of the Olson essay. "I have felt estranged, like a young hawthorn prowling the village at midnight. It is my melancholic strain, as if peering through windows at an alternate reality. Contact brief and fleeting, a handshake with Peter Anastas or Vincent Farini, a night on the floor at Charles Stein's in Berrytown, a quick visit with Jean Day at the Quaker Seed House in Tyringham, a glance into Olson's apartment on the fort when the owner's daughter, seeing us on the stairs, asked if she could help and kindly let me and Irene into the flat which seemed yet to contain Olson's living presence, maps tacked to one wall, papers on a table. At another time, dinner on a deck in the marshlands off the Annisquam with Don Bird and Garrett Lansing when everyone seemed distracted or preoccupied. For many years, Joel Oppenheimer, one of Olson's closest students, lived near me and Irene in the next town north of Ware, Henniker. Joel had also been a student of Paul Goodman's. Joel and I had first met in Bar Harbor in 1976. He died of lung cancer in October 1988. Rose, my daughter, 5 years old at the time of his death, saw a rainbow in the sky over the Unkanunik Mountains as we left Elliott Hospital to return to Ware. Teresa, Joel's wife, later informed us that Joel had passed that afternoon. Joel loved women, it is said, and that was the theme of the memorial service and Kaddish held when he passed. A white dove entered the old white-walled congregational church where the service was held. As the ram's horn, shofar, sounded, the bird perched in the rafters above the coffin. I have been the observer of magical realities. I have seemed an interloper in my own life, sitting near a window and catching a reflection of someone watching me as I read and search for meaning or direction. That watcher, I know, is a version of myself as I once existed, equally a self that might yet materialize. Part of that entity is in these notes, the trope of the observer caught in jars of the time funnel is the organizing figure of my long poem, The House in the Fields." You should get that poem. "Islands breed a clutch of insecurity. Islands breed a clutching insecurity, possibly a trait of Isolatos in general. This brooding paranoia is a symptom shared by the children of alcoholics. Like her dad, Kate abused alcohol, seeking relief from bouts of elegant madness. My mother fled from the ravages of my father's alcoholism to the peaceful refuge of her island home, engendering suspicion and resentments in her children, pitting us, as it were, against an abusive world symbolized by my father. My mother's father had been alcoholic, too. Near her death, Kate began to suspect that she had been a victim of robbery. Brooding on the matter for hours, from her bed she harangued her visitors. Once, redecorating a room with a wallpaper in the style of the English arts and crafts movement, she broke down publicly in tears because of the disapproval expressed by her stepfather, George Bunker. Childhood insecurities, aspirations too, and never far below the surface. From the slightest of tangents to weave the filmy likeness of a life, what that life whispers, always a day later, in some retrospect, as insubstantial and poorly imagined as it may have been at different times, begs acknowledgement. How life submerges in the irrealities of half-claims and half-truths, cheek to cheek with personified terror and paranoia. He held Kate, and he cried, "If I had only known, if I had only known." Yes, the vodka bottle was empty, having rolled under the bed. Tawdry detail, and his children, Audra, Angela, and Andrew, huddled in the room nearby when the revolving red ambulance lights filled the night sky. Willie, my brother, how sweet and loving you have often been, how much we have suffered, so much to learn. I didn't get to read the parts of this that deal with Willie's friendship with Kate, which was close, and he was there for her that night. I have to read one poem about Willie. What time is it? Okay, good. My brother Willie saved my life. My brother Willie was one of the characters walking the shore and doing heroic things, finding tourists who had experienced heart attacks and carrying them home on his shoulders. At 17, he enlisted in the U.S. Army and by various means ended up in Vietnam. About 2 years ago, he died of the consequences of being exposed to Agent Orange. So this completes the story of Kate in some way, for me at least, and it's a poem. My brother William, drowning inside the ventilator mask, his face no longer his, was it ever? His smile, his tears, he suffered like our dad, the lost, unloved boys. Designated to cut timbers soaked in the pesticide that ate his flesh, mindless, buried Vietnam's emissary of boundless goodwill, unrelenting abjection, impossible promises. I massage your feet. They grow cold like meat, so like my own, so like our mother's. The maternal body engulfs her sons. The youngest, he, carried a sign, embedded carbuncular lesions, his back shredded under the lash of chloracne. Sacrifice this one, they said. Glory or redemption, the same old lies. It hurts to be desperately hungry, stomach and balls, selected to be slapped around. It caves the mind. History marked him, not proclivity. He failed to impress the drugged lords of his unit. He failed so badly that it hurt. Put into traces, he hauled stones for a retaining wall, his prison. Others, equally not at home, recognize in him their brother. See how I keep bringing stones back? And if you will bear with me, I'd like to read some new work. Is that okay? It's not in any sense more uplifting than what I just read. I'm in a morbid frame of mind. This is the second.
How old was your brother?
When he died, he would have been, wouldn't have been that, 51? He left the three children that were mentioned at Kate's death as being there when the ambulance arrived to take her away. And those children have major life issues in front of them. His is another story of someone self-medicating through alcohol. That's part of why he let himself go as much as he did. But he also let himself go because he was getting no help for his handicaps and afflictions related to the war. I mean, it's hard for me to think that these poems I'm going to read now are worth anything, but I want to read them. I think it's interesting to be an avant-garde poet and actually have emotional relations that are so much on the surface of your work. Maybe I'm not an avant-garde poet. I don't know. Each of these poems has a reference to bees. It's the second collection of references to bees that I've written. I think it's Virgil's Georgics has book 3 or 4 devoted to beekeeping. Sort of a postmodern Georgics. Some bees. Virgil advised, be not ashamed to saturate the arid soil with dung. Scatter charred ash over weary fields. The adulterated blood of dead bulls generates flies. Smooth bones gleam. Ants feed on honeyed treacle, amanita, sun-carved land of water ribbons. Travelers on that dusty road trudge, head bent, ascending stairs of light, choral hum. The hive bends the bough, liquefied song, Pythagorean remnant. I have a few footnotes to read. This one is, the beehive cluster is a cloud of pollen blown from willow catkins. It is the main celestial object in the 23rd lunar mansion, Guizhou. And this is the best time of year to see the beehive cluster, which is midway on the torso of Cancer. And Cancer happens to be my house. So there's a lot of bee stuff going on here. More bees, Gloucester. All the senses, a swarm of bees, wrote Dorn in Gloucester out. I am unable to keep pace with those who have gone before. I dwell instead on a yellow tuft of compact petals, an unexploded bloom, bone gray calyx, sky so sharp to my multiform eye, endless stained indigo, my human brain lay on the ground, cornflower, wallflower, brittle stones corroded, contact with rough edges, small flints imprint skin, haut, dehaut, the German word, hide impervious and rubbery, the red stain turns hands to gloves, I work my lover's breasts into slick cones. It's like bees how the senses shape memories of flesh and petal, delving in the garden to separate roots, hairs that stanch old lesions. balconies, where the Lord sat in copes of brocade, masks of papier-mâché, flesh pink of junco, heavy mascara flows from eye sockets. Not only chance, it must happen as if awaited. The eyes reappear when a somnambulist stalks a country fair. Then there is the nose, superior to other sniffers, oversized, operatic on one nostril, across a plastic tape, cantridge of multiple projections, shadow drawing with lamp light, swaths of charcoal turned on edge suggest a swarm, bees in an updraft, tap, dance, honeycomb, archive. You went to Cantridge's Norton lectures, didn't you, or one of them? The Nose by Shostakovich, a funny, funny opera. A prayer. Beatrice, blessed one, supreme fetish of the soul, the poet's narcissistic pursuit of self-love knows no bounds. Abyss and mirror, seducing flesh through metaphor, divine love is radiance swimming in a well of light. The male poet's mental vagina and womb, entrance to an inner world that enfolds the world, male and female reversed, reversible, involute, silk flags float over peonies, navigating labyrinthine whorls, a solitary soul. That was written for Forrest Bess. Does anybody know who Forrest Bess was? He was an avant-garde artist associated with Pollock and stuff, but he took as the canvas his own body, and he tried to physically, through self-surgery, create a vagina at the base of his penis. Cosmic threads. In the vinyl cells of an ice cube tray, among the hooks and sinkers, were bees of Merovingian design, immortal like the golden bream that graced the emperor's pool. Napoleon at Versailles, or Yu Huang, the jade emperor who dims the Milky Way the seventh day of the seventh moon, who knows the efficacy of the formula that turns lead to gold, unless she stands back like Vega in her longing for Altair and tracks the shadows on the lawn where bulls decay and spawn the humble bee. I'll skip one. Endgame. That poem is actually in the Cranberry Island sequence, but these come and go. Endgame. Incremental changes. Incremental change succumbs to cataclysmic upheaval. Islands disappear. Swimmers no longer reach the shore. Instead, 20% of us ask ourselves if we have given as much blood as we might have done. The security of our lineage was thought paramount. Among us were chiefs for reason of human decency. Explain why so many now have the same dreams. Children miscarried and adults misidentified in our palliative care facilities. The train runs on reefs of refuse that slide into chemical rivers, leaking magenta dyes and syringes. Simooms like tidal waves rise in the mountains of the continental divide. During the day, humans crawl over the sand, turtles gravid with eggs, looking for a patch of sun in which to warm weary bones. The feeding tubes are dry. No desert roses bloom. No bees hum. Only pumps cough and recoil, spin, purge, and suck. The Sweep of Time. We sweep old enemies aside, ignore their presence under the bed. Instead, we map the stars from multiple points of view and tread on barnacles that cut our feet. Merciless, vengeful knives sear the diabetic heart. Our daughters heal our lacerations, press globs of tar into our wounds. I look up into the light as if from under the ocean, gasping as Plato described, enlightened fish that slither on the operating table. Far to the east of where I've been, holding a cup of tea, a farmer warms his hands. His machine plays a bagatelle for Elise incessantly. In some versions, the bride floats over rooftops, her belly swollen with hope. In others, she is caught between sheets of glass while coral reefs expire. A proletarian poet in a felted cap comments that cod have vanished from the rippled bottom of the sea, as has the lamb who shouldered a cross of gold. Water levels recede, the flesh of his child bride as slippery as oysters. After the meteor explodes, a quaking cold descends. In the bloated belly of time, as if it were a whale, this same old man, perhaps myself in my old age, sought to marry my mother. Her biscuits were sublime. He watched the ticker tape cascade under a glass bell. We lived in Germany once, or in Siberia, and mined sub-oceanic coal for power plants in New Jersey. Bees no longer pollinate the rolling plains of Wyoming. A man with many hearts, it has been said, his hand reached inside his jacket. Napoleonic, he stood on the dunes of Oregon and thought the Pacific his. Anchovies washed ashore in a shark-infested frenzy, filled baskets and pickups, too many to harvest. Small things dying as before, their spawn, oily sweet, remembered horseflies, hum. I'll read this last poem. It's called Maryland. There's a lot of male melancholy in these. This is another poem about my father, I guess. My father took my precious books in cloth of gold to punish me and compensate his overlords for the one that I had lost. I can't remember having read Juan of Bordeaux, but surely did. That summer I'd have been 8 or 9 and precocious, reading with one eye on the page, my wandering eye covered by a patch after surgery. I'm trying to return to a scene of writing other than one shaped by resentment and grief, but can't. The walk from our quarters to the center went through fields, woods, a brook. I took my sisters, Mary and Margaret, to the matinee. I studied the water skaters on the pond. I crouched among weeping willows and heard trumpets. Yellow leaves trailed upon the water, images of heroism and slaughter and boys in uniform. Not me, certainly not me. I was not allowed to play. I admired the fierce Saracens. Maryland, my Maryland of the Baltimore Catechism, scene of prepubescent lust, my gabardine pockets filled with dimes and quarters, mortification caused by that clinking weight of tarnished treasure. The father of the girl I had selected to be my queen of the cedar forest would not let us roam beyond the pale of his domain. Another time I constructed an Arab caravan and airy palace made of tablecloths. It seems two different worlds, the one dominated by my father's rage, the other my romance of virility and heroic action. He beat me for destroying the silks and linens. It was the summer of eyeglasses smashed into my face until my teeth bled. It is the story of how I became a poet. I'm going to read one more poem. Sorry. This one has a footnote. That's too bleak a note. I could read two more, but anyway, just one more. This is the footnote. Juan of Bordeaux is the title character of a 13th century French epic. He is a knight to whom, after unwittingly killing the son of the Emperor Charlemagne, is given a reprieve from death on condition that he fulfill a number of impossible tasks. He must travel to the court of the Emir in Babylon and return with a handful of the Emir's hair and teeth, kill the Emir's mightiest knight, and three times kiss the Emir's daughter, Esclarmonde. I do not remember the details of the romance. Instead, I celebrate my own sufferings. I am the unworthy son. I hear the leaden drones of Merovingian bees, symbols of immortality. In 1951, by executive order, President Harry Truman desegregated the United States Army. The playground set aside for use by black children became the site of controversy between my father and his commanding officer as to who was allowed to play there and who was allowed to be chased by sticks and stones. My sense of a need for permission has remained constant. Yes, I have been reading Robert Duncan while composing these lines. Even when there is no one to turn to, this need for permission affects the ways in which I allow my behavior to become the subject of observation. The holly bush of mythic lore has prickly and glabrous leaves and is common in the mid-Atlantic region. Duncan wrote, remembering his Aunt Fay, the soul itself, a swarm of entities, most like bees. One more poem now. It's another art poem. It's called Milkstones. And it was written on viewing photographs of Wolfgang Leib's wax rooms in the Phillips Collection. Actually, I mentioned the Phillips Collection in Washington, D.C. several times in that book I was reading from. He is a fascinating guy, and this says a little bit, but he's an avant-garde artist, but he has been making all of his works out of beeswax. I don't know. I'm going to read the poem anyway. Milkstones. Pearlescent pools on the marble surface. His family treasured Maevich's white on white. Sifting hazelnut pollen to create a luminous dance space on the museum floor. To leave tracks there impairs the glow, saffron feet. A wax-walled cell in which to hear the pounding of the heart and breathe the honey musk deposited on walls. Meditation seeps like honey dew and slows the breath. Thank you. Any more questions? Anything's fine. Ah, that might have been mine. This works.
How did you overcome resentment, which was so strong with your father? By writing?
I don't know. I have this absolute Jesuitical resolve. I was reading Nietzsche at one point, and he said resentment is what belittles humans and destroys their nobility. And I said, that's my credo. So it's from books.
So you did,
yeah. And I try to honor my father. There's a beautiful poem, in a sense, about my father in this book. It's not all negativity. But I'm a father, too, so there's a lot of cause for reflection.
If it's any consolation, I have a friend who's a Vietnam combat hero, and after a successful teaching career in California, retired with a pension there, he was also kind of happy to find that the VA also granted him a 100% disability for PTSD, but while enjoying that, he's just recently found that he has pre-diabetic symptoms from Agent Orange.
Oh, wow.
Ultimate kicker. So there's all kinds of people, but they never actually allowed that for a long time, that Agent Orange was causing these particular
Absolutely.
Symptoms. So.
These are amazing stories. My brother was a stupid kid, but I owe him my life. Because he went to Vietnam, I did not go to Vietnam. Mm. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
So, it's hard. It's hard and simple at the same time. He went to Vietnam because at 17 he was unable to accept military discipline. He got into trouble. They told him, "You'll get out of the stockade if you volunteer for Vietnam." He was still 17. I can't believe our government does that to 17-year-old boys. But that's what happened. And that's what saved me from going to Vietnam.
Was he aware that Agent Orange was the cause of this?
Later on, for sure. I mean, he didn't have much of an education. His life was working on the ocean or in the fields. So with his condition, he'd suffer migraines after 2 or 3 hours of working in any hot sun. And they finally gave him a 45% physical disability, which was enough to keep him in booze until he died.
Was it that you couldn't be recruited because they wouldn't recruit two brothers from the family?
They wouldn't send me to Vietnam. I had a very interesting military experience. I talked about Evan Jones and learning about Olsen there. I had advanced basic training with kids. All of us had master's degree. We were like the last group to be drafted at 25 years old. Some of us continued to be friends. I read the complete works of Henry James and George Eliot while on duty in Germany, just sitting in the office doing nothing else. And that way I was blessed.
But how did his going save you?
Because they wouldn't send two brothers to the campaign area, right. But they took me. It's just that... they sent me someplace else, blessedly. Actually, they sent everybody in my unit. All of us brilliant English people were in my unit, afraid to death that we were being trained to run a warehouse for helicopter repair parts. And since they had to take me out of the unit, they sent everybody in the unit someplace else. That's...
But you don't resent that.
Oh, yeah, I feel... I don't resent my experience. I had difficulties with my wife, who went to Germany with me, too. What I do feel is guilt. I think I made the best of everything that came my way, but other people have suffered, and it was like we were in parallel universes, and, you know, it's mental as much as anything else. I recently went... This is like a confession. I recently went to Singapore because my son married, and I was talking to my ex-wife who was in Germany with me, and I told her, "You know, you were the love of my life." And she turns to me and she said, "I know that. That's why I stayed with you as long as I did, you poor bastard." So you got to see some humor in that, don't you? But, I mean, and to the poetry, this last thing, as this is the stuff I was talking about, writing these very tight lines that have a rhythm in which the end and every comma really counts, and yet it's a narrative poetry. I feel very happy with what I'm doing.
It's more condensed than Baroque.
This is different than Baroque. I was going to footnote. I mean, There was this one, I don't know. His eyes shone in throwbar clue. Talk about condensed. Secret turnings of melodic phrase swum bare-chested in Arctic streams on Kansas Road. Ate scraps of trash fish made bouillabaisse, wolf dog bones and eyes. Bees, brows, stems, sea roses, grizzled barbs erupt from skin. That's an elegy for Ted Enslin, who's a poet in the Olson tradition. Should we get some drink, or you can browse my book collection, too? Thank you. Thank you all.